Breaking news, and this one is almost unbelievable.
Yeah, it's all about new customers at Bet365, because they get $150 in bonus bets when they bet $5, win or lose. And even better, bonus bets can be used on the spread, totals, and player props.
There you have it. Bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. And see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. T&Cs apply. Available in app only.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Squawker Talker. With last week's awards out of the way, we return to analysing football matches as they happen. And joining me to do just that, as well as looking ahead to some Champions League football, is chief writer and endgame connoisseur, Mohammed Butt. How are you?
I'm pretty great. No spoilers, so just go see it.
No spoilers.
Avengers Assemble.
And also, if you've not seen already yet, we've been doing some Endgame Champions League crossover content. Mo's written some great articles there that will be coming out the rest of this week. Van Dijk and
Messi
so are already far. Out. And then we said no spoilers, so we're not going to tell you. We're not going to tell you who's next.
But they're good stuff.
And the man that's had to edit and read those thoroughly through is Will Hall joining us again. Missed the awards last week. Were you surprised with any of the winners?
Yeah. Well, the actual winners of the awards.
Of the Squawker Talker Awards, yeah.
Oh, the Nuno shocked me.
Shocked you.
But
says
the tweet was very popular.
It was very popular, but when your handle is Kloppite number one, is your burner Twitter account. We can't be surprised that you're surprised with that. And Sam Long is returning from, obviously, being on the awards podcast. You've been talking off air about a relegation battle approaching.
Yep, taking it to the last day, so up to Bradford on Saturday.
Up to Bradford for the final.
The glamour of League One.
Yes, but we always like giving it at least 30 seconds on the podcast. So it's great to have you on that. But we're going to start in typical fashion, really, with probably the beefiest Premier League tie of the weekend, although it wasn't the best. Man United and Chelsea played out a 1-1 draw at Old Trafford, and obviously, the talking point, we don't really need to beat around the bush here. David De Gea dropping another clanger. Three errors leading to goals in his last four games, which is as many as his last 123 matches combined. Sam, what is going on with David De Gea?
Well, his confidence just seems to have absolutely deserted him. The curse of the top knot, which Mo brought up during the World Cup, seems to still be there, even though he's cut it off, it's lingering.
Imagine that.
Can we just get Mo to redefine what the curse of the top knot is? Does it linger after the top knot?
Well, I mean, I assume
like
not.
Like breaking a mirror.
I always assume not, but I mean, David De Gea appears to be, maybe it's a seasonal thing. I don't know, you know, spring's back, the curse of the top knot has renewed itself. I don't know, but he does look absolutely, like, either bereft of confidence or just that he's thinking about something else entirely. Is he thinking about
about avoiding Endgame spoilers and Game of Thrones?
You know what? To be fair, if he came out and said that was the reason, I genuinely think everyone would be like, yeah, fair enough.
That would make sense. But genuinely, on terms of the football, top knot curses aside, there was a moment in the game where, obviously, Rudiger's shot from about 30 yards. He drops it into Alonso. Good finish by Alonso to follow up. And obviously, it's Marcus Alonso following up in that position, rather than Higuain, who might have been offside if he did. There was a moment where, obviously, Marcus Rashford had a free kick, fired into Kepa Arrizabalaga, who is obviously David Gea's probably closest rival for that span number one. And he just gobbled it up. So is there an issue? Does De Gea play any more games? Souness said on the Sky Sports coverage that if they drop him now, they'll lose him forever. Is that something that we can see happening, Will?
Sergio Romero is one of the better backup goalkeepers in the Premier League, so it could happen. I don't think necessarily you can really make a call on how David De Gea is going to react to getting dropped. It is a very delicate situation, but I don't think you can be held to ransom like that.
Because they've still
with a sort of on-field team decision.
Yeah, they've still not actually sorted his contract yet, I don't think. Mm-hmm. There were rumours that they'd sort of agreed it, but that's still lingering. But he was a reason, he's been the reason for so long that they finished second last year. I remember we spoke about that a lot on the podcast. His expected goals saved was almost freakish. It was 15 goals he'd saved. And this season, he seems to just reverted to the mean. So it was what we said about why Jose Mourinho's season last season, him saying it was his best, was maybe intensified was because David De Gea in goal was performing miracles. When David De Gea doesn't perform miracles and even goes beyond that, then they sort of revert to being quite a normal team, which is what Chelsea are as well. And
I mean, you know, you said it was a beefy match, right? But that was not a prime cut. That was awful, that match, really. But between the two of them, just really neither side looked capable of anything of note, in all honesty. Like, the Man United goal was beautiful, and now, like, for like 15 minutes, you're thinking, okay, United are at it again. Here we go. They're back in the... Ollie's at the wheel, back in the saddle, all that stuff. Scored a beautiful goal. And then Lukaku was so up for it as well.
I was going to say, if someone was hungry, that's him.
Well, he absolutely beasted Azpilicueta.
He was just phenomenal. Like he was using his strength, which he never does. He used his strength to his advantage. His technique was great. His movement was exceptional. He was constantly appearing out wide, pinging crosses in. It was like he really wanted to win the game. But he's a huge guy, and even the commentators noticed it. He slowed down dramatically after about half an hour because it's like you can't run at that pace when you're that big.
And the stat that came out from that though is that he didn't cover much different distance, but he actually made the most sprints of any Man United player in that game. Which all of this stuff, there seems to have this time of year again, there seems to be a clamouring for who's covered the most difference. There was that walking stat going around about Paul Pogba, that he walks the most of any Premier League midfielder, which is pretty silly considering Messi probably spends about 50% of the time.
I guarantee you Messi walks more than any other player in top five leagues, any other elite player in top five leagues. It doesn't make a difference. It's sprints, isn't it?
So I'm not saying the sprints is important to the extent, but it shouldn't define his performance. His first half was very good, and that ball to Luke Shaw, we started seeing that the glimpses of the complete forward he can be. It's just the fact that he seemed to run out of steam after 30 minutes, looking like he had a point to prove.
Yeah, I mean, and he kind of does, because obviously he was really good last season. This season started off terribly, hit a bit of form in the spring, then picked up a knock, and then United's sort of drop off in form coincided with him going out, because he was the one dragging them through things. Remember, he scored twice against PSG. You know, he was the guy getting the goals. He was the guy making the difference. So it's he does kind of have a point to prove, but I think a lot of United players, I think that one thing that maybe hasn't been talked about that much is the degree of which they were unfit under Mourinho. I think Solskjaer's mentioned it a couple of times, but they just don't look capable of sustaining quality football over an entire match, especially now that they're playing with intensity. Like with Mourinho, they were parking it, playing very sort of low intensity stuff. Under Solskjaer, they want to play high intensity stuff, and I don't think the players are fit enough for it. I think a full preseason, will yield much different results for United, because they'll just have more energy, and they're constantly picking up injuries because they're pushing them so hard.
I agree with maybe that they weren't fit enough or whatever under Mourinho, but Gary Neville was talking about it and saying that if you're at a club at Man United stature, you're going to be on a regime. So maybe Ole Gunnar Solskjaer needs to be... Maybe it's a mismanagement in the sense that he needs to realise his players are unfit, stop making them steam around the pitch for 90 minutes expecting them not to tire.
That's what I would say. I think Solskjaer, for all the good stuff that he's done, has made a few little mistakes here and there. Like, for example, not diagnosing the fact that, as you say, the players probably aren't fit enough to play his kind of football. Maybe dial it back a notch, and maybe try and play... Like Klopp, did Klopp realise you can't play... Well, Klopp doesn't know this, but you can't play Klopp football for an entire season and win a league title. You can't do it. So he's changed Liverpool style, and look at the benefits, you know?
And that's the thing as well. The little tweak is... Sarri is criticised for not tweaking it. If his players do not fit his system, he's not tweaked it at all. And he's been absolutely hammered for that. So yes, you can say Solskjaer doesn't have the fittest players on earth, but don't use them as if they are the fittest players on earth then as well. That's what management is about. But flipping it over to Chelsea, Will, is this, given the results of no one wanting to win in the top four this season and Leicester absolutely pummeling Arsenal at the King Power Stadium, was that a missed opportunity for Chelsea, or is this, have they done enough to secure top four?
No, because it does look like they have done enough. It was very important that they didn't lose another game to a top six side, which has been kind of the story of 2019 for them. And in recent weeks, we've seen Chelsea clamber above Man United in the table, and in terms of this contest to see who is the biggest loser out of that top six side, because we'll learn next week whether Man United's season is over, essentially, because if they miss out on top four, they are the only one in that big six that's not really competing for something big at the end of the season. So obviously Spurs have got this Champions League semi-final. Man City, probably the league title, looks like. Also an FA Cup final. Liverpool, Champions League semi-final and the league title. But yeah, Man United have enough from that. Even Arsenal have potentially.
Even Arsenal have something.
Yeah. But Maurizio Sarri's problem is really about optics, because if you look at his season, the achievements you could list are cup final, looks like a top four finish. Only big six team, I think, to beat Man City in the league this season. But they've all been tainted by sort of events, essentially, like Aretha Balaga's like refusal to be substituted
in
the cup final. Yeah. Man City exacted their revenge with like a 6-0 defeat in the league in February, I think. So, and then top four, as you've alluded to there, while the title race has kind of fostered excellence out of Man City and Liverpool, the top four race just seems to have fostered incompetence in that all the teams are sort of just dropping points, and that's sort of potentially playing on the minds of the other teams involved in the battle for Champions League qualification.
I think fair play to Sarri, really, because he's got so much criticism early in the season, and he sort of preached that it's going to take a long time, it's not going to sort of come overnight, and if he finishes the season top four, Europa League final, Capital One Cup final.
Well, they're favourites to win the Europa League, so I basically think the point I was getting to there was that the season depends on the Europa League is what could potentially buy him the grace among the fans that he needs, because he's kind of become a Van Gaal-esque figure in terms of like this not having lacking the charisma. Well, maybe charisma is not necessarily the word, but refusing to play the game and sort of appease fans while during periods in which the style of football is not really working, not really shining, has lost its fizz. And that was definitely the case in like late January, February, when they had that awful run. And
sounds like you're saying the Europa League is Europe's elite competition in terms of what they will decide.
I think
I think Arsenal are going to win the Europa League. I think first, just to bring that back to that, I think that's that because, and they're going to have to because they are spiraling out of control in the league.
Haven't got a section on Arsenal, but just quickly on that,
they were very bad.
There was nothing good about that.
Yeah, they were very, very well. Leno was very good. He was very, very good. And shout out to Leno, because I think none of us, especially me, I'd like to say I wasn't very impressed when they signed. I thought that's a bit of a middling signing. Yeah. He's not there, but he's really come good second half season. Been really, really good. It was very impressive in that game. No one else was really. But I just, you look at United, I think there's still a chance for United to make top four, because I think Chelsea have got a couple of tricky games, Leicester in particular, not the easiest game. And I think United have no distractions. Those guys have got to juggle the semi-finals of the Europa League, which is that takes a lot of attention. As we saw from Arsenal, Arsenal can't juggle two competitions, we've seen this. Can Chelsea? I'm not entirely sure, especially with their away form. So it's not over, but it's like very much almost over. I do think Chelsea have a very, very big advantage, even if they fail to win.
Well, Leicester could be the most important team in the title race that aren't actually in the title race.
I mean,
they've obviously just spanked Arsenal. They've got Man City to play, and then they're going to have some say in who finishes in top four as well. But let's move on to that title race, which is officially now the first time in Premier League history that a runner-up will have more than 90 points. So at the moment, it's just, as Will said there, the quality of those two sides is so far and beyond anyone else in the league. It's almost quite poetic that the ties will be decided by those millimeters on that goal decision system, but the gap between the rest of the league is miles. Man City, obviously, we had Liverpool absolutely spank Huddersfield, which everyone expected to happen on Friday night football, with which was what a really interesting stat, in that they had all African scorers, five, which was the most by that continent in a single game, which was a really cool stat from that game in itself, with Keita getting a 15-second goal as well. But then Man City ground down Burnley with agent Ashley Barnes in the side. But it's almost that Burnley game was going to be the last point, really, it looked like, in their fixture that could have caused them issues. And it so very nearly did, if not for Aguero's winner. So is it now, I think you sort of almost said there, Will, that you expect Man City to win it now.
Well, I do, but I would say that it's difficult to... The problem with looking at the fixture list in advance is that on paper, yes, you could look at that Burnley game and then their record against the reigning champions in previous seasons was like quite good. So everyone was using that as an omen ahead of the Man City game. But like form and timing just utterly changes the complexion of of title run-ins, because it's not really about who you play, it's about when you play them. And I kind of said this a couple of weeks ago in the context of the Bundesliga title race. But, I mean, the problem Man City have now is that, yes, it looked like Burnley would be the last test, but as you said there, they now go play Leicester, who have won, I think, the most points outside of Liverpool and Man City since Brendan Rodgers took over. It's beginning to look pretty clear why Rodgers was in such a hurry to leave Celtic, because, I mean, this team is just like doing bits underneath him. And,
yeah.
And it's stacked with talent, and they already look like they're ready to really sort of challenge to be the best of the rest next season, I would go so far to say. And they are actually, I think, in contention for that seventh place spot in the league that could result in Europa League qualification should Man City win the FA Cup.
The one thing I will say about Leicester, I do agree, I think they're phenomenal. I think they're really, really good. They're playing really well right now as well, is they're going to come out and play City, which gives them a little bit more opportunity. Like part of the reason why their recent games have been so tense is because United, Spurs, and then especially Burnley just sat very deep, frustrated them, and then looked to hit them on the break. And of course, City committed men forward. There's like two men left in defence. One of them is Vinny Kompany, who has the turning circle of a oil tanker. So, you know, it was kind of, you know, they were sort of set up to make for very frustrating, tense games. And City eventually saw through all three of them, 1-0, 2-0, 1-0. And I think that's very impressive. You've got to shout out their defence, man. They've got Edison, what was it, 19th clean sheet, 22 goals conceded this season. That's only like Liverpool have 20 and 20 goals conceded. So they're not even far off Liverpool, who are, as we're referencing, like, a phenomenal defensive side.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, Edison set a record for most. Looks like Pep Guardiola was right. Mm. All along, 19th clean sheet, the most by a Man City goalkeeper in a single season. But Will, it looked like you had something to add.
The other thing to point out with talk about like what are the major hurdles in City's running is like they think they've dropped 5 points in this Big Six mini league this season out of a possible 30, which is a better record than last season. Yet they've lost to Newcastle, Palace, and Leicester already, I believe. So
all managed by
former. Mm. Well, one of them wasn't at the time, but yeah. All managed by former Liverpool managers.
Yeah, so. Now and who's next?
And who's next? Brendan Rodgers. Maybe we'll get that statue outside.
The title race is I think it's been phenomenal. I think it's been magnificent entertainment. It's turned the Premier League into the Southern SPL, you know, all those cracks about La Liga being the sunny SPL. Well, now well, England isn't exactly sunny, so let's just say it's the Southern SPL, you know, two-team league. Those, no one else is close to Liverpool, Man City. Like, I know there was all the hoopla about Spurs, but that was illusory, and it got revealed to be so. These two are so much better than everyone else. It's ridiculous. And it's actually quite, you look at it, you compare it to the 2009-10 La Liga title race, which was when Pep Guardiola's Barcelona finished with 99 points and Real Madrid finished with six, Manuel Pellegrini's Real Madrid finished with 96. And Pellegrini got sacked, by the way, for 96 points. But Liverpool, I mean, it could physically end, what, 98, 97?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's ridiculous. I mean, you look at it now. I mean, Liverpool have only lost one game, but they've drawn seven. Those draws at the start of this year, 2019, look like they're going to probably be the difference. I mean, you never know. Obviously, Man City could still do something. But I mean,
well, Man City are on a 12-game winning streak. Yeah,
exactly. I think that's more the thing that just is making not just me but pretty much everyone sort of assume that's it done now. But I mean, if it goes down to the final day and all teams are playing at the same time, and if Brighton, who Man City play on the final day, get like a lucky goal or something like that, that's going to wreck heads. Like,
watching Brighton, I don't think they're going to be.
That's why I had to. That's why I used the word lucky.
I think it has to be settled. The penultimate weekend. I think if it goes to the final weekend, Liverpool have got a much harder game in Wolves. I think it has to be. If Liverpool can go ahead, if Leicester can do them a favour and Liverpool take the advantage this weekend.
Well, Jurgen Klopp can exact revenge on the Squawker Talker Award, Injustice, by Will, against the man that pipped him. And Guardiola was third in that vote.
Exactly.
So just a final thought on this then, Sam. Man City, Liverpool, Edison, Alisson. Who would have thought two Brazilian goalkeepers would have such a key part in a title race as well? Because, yes, Van Dijk, who, as we know now, is PFA Players Player of the Year, has been a major transformative signing. But that goalkeeper upgrade, in the same way that Edison was that upgrade for Man City and enabling that style of play that Guardiola wanted to play, they deserve really massive credit. And Edison was named in the team of the year instead of Alisson, despite having a fewer clean sheets.
They seem destined to sort of always be compared to each other for their whole careers now, don't they? And like we touched on with the teams, they've been streets ahead of the other competitors, especially when you think back that Chelsea and Arsenal have both signed new keepers. So it was going to be you know, several new teams with new goalkeepers. But yeah, they're so difficult to split. Obviously, Alisson is the Brazil number one. So who am I to maybe question that? But I think I would
it's
go
kind
for...
It's kind of your job at the moment, though. Yeah.
I think I would go for Edison purely for his distribution, whether he's kicking from the hand or from the floor. Obviously, his goal kicks are incredible.
They're Guinness World Record.
Guinness World Record worthy. I'm just a huge fan of the calmness that he can bring to the whole defence. He almost plays another defender. Of course, people will always level the accusation of, oh, well, he's there to save shots and not make passes. But he just allows Man City to play out from the back, and it suits Guardiola perfectly.
He proved against Spurs that he's very good at also saving shots as well. So, yeah, those two goalkeepers are...
There's a convincing argument to be made that though they are two of the best five goalkeepers in the world, I think, you know, along with Ter Stegen and Oblak in La Liga... And then maybe Handanovic as well for Inter, you know.
De Gea's victim of recency bias there.
Yeah, but no, I mean, it's not just bad. He's playing terribly.
I know, everyone knows. And Antonio Valencia did an Instagram post saying, you've been the best today.
Even his Manchester United teammate has to say nice things.
No, to be fair, though, it does seem like...
No one's seen Valencia talk in 2 months.
It does seem like carrying Man United for all those years, which he has done. Make no mistake about it. Exactly. He has been. It's like it's taken its toll and he just looks like... Plus, also, he could honestly be like... courting interest from elsewhere. It's that time of season.
Yeah, I think you're way too cynical.
And it could be. No. Not that he doesn't care anymore, but I mean, like, it's distracting him. Like, maybe his agent's like, oh, so-and-so has offered you, like, maybe Juventus are coming in for you or whatever. And it could just be distracting him because he just looks like, it's not just bad form right now. It's a bit more than bad form. Something just looks desperately wrong with him.
Yeah. Well, let's move on from champions to be to championship. With Norwich and Sheffield United sealing promotion. No one has won the title yet. But this weekend in the Championship was crazy. Let's deal with the promoted teams first. Obviously, Norwich and Sheffield United both being praised hugely for the football that's been played. Chris Wilder, in the job that he's done at Sheffield United in general, has been nothing short of magnificent. Daniel Farker as well, a school from the sort of same origins as Jurgen Klopp, really, in that respect, came in, wanted to be a director of football rather than a manager, but he's proved by making one of the most exciting teams in the Championship and getting them promotion, has proven to be a pretty good manager as well. In terms of those two teams, and who do you think has done the better job, Sam, in that area? Have you got any thoughts on who you'd lean towards? You all of the comparisons this week as well.
I mean, it's very easy to make a case for both of them, so it's very difficult to answer. Obviously, Norwich finished 14th last season, had a difficult summer in that Madison left, both the Murphys left. Fans had every right to sort of be fearing the worst before the season started. And Farker had some bad results towards the start of the season, around September time. He was almost being hounded out, but he stuck to his guns. And proved to be very, very shrewd in the transfer market. You just got to look at Pukki. People wouldn't even really heard of him. Come in and scored tons of goals. Shown faith in youth as well. The likes of Max Ahrens only made his debut in sort of September. And it's worth pointing out as well that with the transfer business that they've done, they have Stuart Webber, who is their sporting director, who... was also at Huddersfield and had quite a big role in the sort of David Wagner era. So they've done really well. But I think I would go for Wilder purely because...
You've led us around. Yeah.
Despite everything I've just said for the past 5 minutes.
So, I mean, as we know, I'm an absolute EFL merchant and he has come from the bottom to the top. So he's earned promotion from Conference, League Two, League One, and now the Championship. And if anyone deserves to have a crack at the Premier League, it's him. They've got the best defence in the Championship this season, like considerably better than the likes of the Norwich. Norwich conceded 56, whereas Sheffield United have only conceded 39. Given that he's a local lad, and like I've touched on, he's come all the way through the divisions, I'm going to go for Wilder.
It's interesting as well. Dean Henderson is a Sheffield United goalkeeper, part of that defence, on loan from Manchester United.
Mm.
De Gea, Dean Henderson's Dean Henderson's coming from a youth.
I mean, I was just going to try and I think the fact that Wilder's a local lad, I think he just that's something pretty special with that
romance.
Yeah, you know, and especially because Sheffield have waited so long. When was the last time Sheffield had a presence in the Premier League? And it'd be good to have one back. It's a shame it's not Wednesday, just because they're a team called Wednesday, which I just think is just fantastic.
The
United are really good.
Not to rain on Wilder's parade, because I very much agree that is an incredible story, and you really want him to do well next season in the Premier League. But the Farker stuff and the Norwich style of play, two fullbacks were both named in Team of the Year, 21-year-old Jamal Lewis and Max Aaron's teenager right back. We know another German manager that's had a very successful season funneling his style of play into two young fullbacks. So I thought there were quite nice parallels there. And Norwich themselves have been exciting to watch.
Yeah.
Just quickly on the actual style of play, maybe, and what's maybe to expect from the two sides next season, Mo?
I think Norwich is going to scale a lot better than... I mean, Sheffield United, you know, they can be physical side, they've got three at the back. You know, they're a solid side, but you just wonder... You know, where the goals are going to come from? Is Billy Sharp going to... Is his production going to scale into the Premier League? I'm not entirely sure. Whereas you look at Norwich, and they've got a much more defined system of playing in attack anyway. Much more system that, like you said, two young fullbacks. That's the thing. They're very strong at fullback. That's going to help them hugely scale into the Premier League, actually produce goals. It's just a matter of if Pukki can... Because he scores loads of goals. He's top scorer of the Championship, but he also misses a lot of chances as well. So it's just a matter of what's his miss-to-goal ratio going to be like next year?
Well, it's the same. As long as they're creating the chances. Salah,
yeah, you would think so. I do think that Norwich's style is going to scale better. And Farker, I think, is a bit more of an astute kind of manager. But I mean, I'm not to downplay Wilder, who I think has done brilliantly. But
well,
I just think
we were all full of praise for Fulham as they were promoted.
Yeah,
last
this
season,
was. Yeah,
and they've been absolutely dire. Scott Parker doing three wins in a row somehow, and is.
Yeah.
Where was that before? They needed Babel at the start of the season. Sam, you raising your hand?
Yeah, I just wanted to make another point on Sheffield United. Interestingly, their entire squad is British. With four Irishmen and two Scotsmen. So it's going to be interesting to see whether they look abroad at all. Obviously, once you're in the Prem, it opens up so many more doors. But I've got a feeling that Wilder's going to be more likely to dip into the Championship and the lower leagues to sort of pick up some bargains there, which, well, as we know,
I think both teams are going to want to learn from Fulham in terms of if you just absolutely go out there and buy a new team, then...
Yeah. Mm. And as well... At the moment, you want to be buying English, because my word, do we have some good players. Look at the people that might be available on loan as well next season. If you look at like some Mason Mount, Reece James at Wigan this season, who was also named in the Championship team of the year, I think.
If Mason Mount can't get in Chelsea's team next year, I might just cry.
Well, that's the thing. He might now have a season in the Premier League with a team like this. So English market is definitely one that you should be looking at. It just comes at a bit of a premium. There's one more place to decide in the coming up to the Premier League, though, and we must talk about what on earth happened between Leeds and Aston Villa this weekend, Sam. I wonder if you can shed any light. For anyone that has somehow missed it, Marcelo Bielsa special, by all means.
Yeah, it was just absolutely bizarre situation. So Villa had a player, went down injured. Leeds... looks like they were going to put it out, which I think is sort of the crux of the matter, because he slowed the game right down, Villa players relaxed, and then sent a defence splitting through ball down the line. Obviously, Leeds go through and score. And then after much confrontation and expletives from John Terry aimed at Bielsa, he allowed them to score the whoop through goal. But not everyone got the message. And it was almost bundled over at Domer as he was running through on goal. So it ended 1-1. But obviously that paved the way for Sheffield United to be promoted.
To be promoted, yeah. And then so Leeds now, who looked so strong at the start of the season, and look, they've fallen off.
A Bielsa side falling off in the last few... Look, when we can play football with robots, Marcelo Bielsa will be the greatest manager in the world. Until that day comes, this will always happen to me. And he says it himself. He's like, I'm not the greatest coach in the world. I have flaws. And this is one of his flaws. He pushes his players so hard that at the end of the league season, they just collapse. They can't take it anymore.
Well, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer can say that he's got a bit of Bielsa about him then. Well, in the sense that he's just using his players too much.
Just over a much shorter
time. Just overexerted.
Doesn't squat as well, though, does he?
No.
But with Villa, though, so that's 11 games unbeating for them. 10 on the bounce.
10 wins before.
10 wins on the bounce. you almost feel like they could have done with, or they could do with getting the defeat out of their system before the playoffs, sort of like Fulham did last year. They were 23 unbeaten and they lost to Birmingham, I think it was on the last day. And Villa have got Norwich on the final day, so they might end up getting that defeat out of their system
in time for the playoffs. And obviously they're propelled forward by a Chelsea loanee as well up front, Tammy Abraham, named in that team of the year, PFA, with 25 goals.
Basically, the transfer ban shouldn't affect Chelsea, essentially, is what we're saying.
It's a big leap. We're saying that translatable Norwich could be trans, but it's a different thing getting all your players into that team. We would absolutely love Chelsea next season to have Tammy Abraham, Mason Mount, and Reece James in their team. He's in the team anyway. I'm saying is loanees that have made an impact in the Championship this season. Mason Mount came back and has revitalised that derby push as well for playoffs. Tammy Abraham, as I said, top scorer. Reece James has won 90% of every award at Wigan this season. So you would love to see them used, but it's a different thing and it is a huge step. So that'll be interesting to see. Now, though, we're going to be moving away from English football and going on to the continent with a first look at PSG, really, who, despite hiring Thomas Tuchel at the beginning of the season, so much was expected. A second season of Kylian Mbappe, who, to be fair to him, has scored 30 goals and been quite magnificent. Neymar injuries and Champions League woes have all sort of ended and culminated into a mini remontada, which I think Hatem Ben Arfa referred to it to. Stade Rennes coming from 2-0 down in the Coupe de France final to beat PSG on penalties. And this means it's the first time since the 2012-13 season that PSG have only won one trophy within the season, the Trophy de Champion before the season, Community Shield equivalent, not included there. So my question really is, with PSG having this sort of mini meltdown, Tuchel, we know, is explosive. I think there were reasons why he left Dortmund because of that and his certain opinions on certain players and not hiding those opinions. Can we see Tuchel getting binned off already at the Parc des Princes?
Well, their track record with managers since the new ownership came in 2011, since the takeover, has suggests that he probably will be given another season. So they've actually only really sacked one manager since taking over. That was Laurent Blanc, and he was their most successful manager in terms of domestic cups and league titles of all time, essentially, with 11 trophies. Ancelotti was the first, left for Real Madrid after 2 years. Laurent Blanc, as I said, their most successful from 2013 to 2016, was eventually sacked, I think, following the defeat to Man City in the quarterfinals. So that was obviously related to the lack of progress in the Champions League. Mm. Unai Emery obviously won the domestic treble and I think his second season there. But interestingly, I mean, when people refer to like why he failed at PSG, I feel like less people really pick out the fact that they lost the league title to Monaco, which is the bigger shock, really, and more people look at, as you refer to there, the initial remontado, the defeat to Barcelona, the 6-1 defeat in the second leg. So once taking all this on board, I think you can kind of almost, not disregard, but the failures in the cups to Rennes and the elimination of the Coupe de France to Guingamp sort of pale in significance, really. And then it just becomes all about the Champions League. And obviously the elimination at the hands of Manchester United was pretty epic. Maybe not remontado levels of bottling a match, but
they were
not far away.
They were super dominant.
And also, as we've referred to this Klopp comment previously, like they were quite unlucky, really, with that handball. And then people forget the performance against Liverpool in the group stage was lauded as one of these all-too-rare, truly elite performances from Paris Saint-Germain in the Champions League. There's also mitigating factors in terms of the fact that the squad seems to have regressed a little bit with Motta bowing out and Thiago Silva sort of having been waning in terms of his powers over several seasons now. The fact that his sporting director sort of exiled one of his best midfielders due to the contract dispute Lassana Diarra was released and then subsequently retired as well. And then the Neymar injury, which is an annual occurrence now, really, at the same exact stage of the Champions League. So those are mitigating factors. And the trend suggests that he might be given another season, because I think at this stage, the chairman, Nasser Al-Khelaifi, is going to start looking bad. He's almost going to Woodward himself pretty soon in terms of all these managerial hires having really failed in their sort of... in their main objective, which is Champions League success. And just to finish this overview, it's worth remembering, as I've said, how impressive they were against Liverpool and how unfortunate they really are to have lost Neymar with the exact same injury at the exact same stage. And I think once we've all sort of stopped pointing and laughing at the least popular club in Europe, there's like a sense of sadness that almost creeps in, or disappointment that we've kind of been deprived seeing Neymar, who's like tipped to break into the Messi-Ronaldo sort of discussion, sort of deprived of his stance, his chance to sort of show what he can do on the biggest of stages, and now he's just a guy that goes around punching people and slating the younger players in the squad.
I think Mo once did say that, I remember we were sort of focusing some content on the fact that he beat Kaká's record as the most goals in Champions League by a Brazilian. And it was saying that he needs to do a bit more to avoid becoming just a meme of himself, which he pretty much has become.
Yeah.
That video during the defeat to Man United, where he's like blinking and staring around, not believing what's happened. and also
the rolling over as well. There's been sort of
the rolling over, and also now sort of throwing some sort of punch to a fan, what it looks like. Again, like allegedly a punch. He pretty much went for this guy, but there wasn't much force behind it. But his record at PSG is amazing. Whenever you watch him play, he scored and assisted in that final. He is an incredible player. And
he's a ridiculous... This is the thing, because it's very easy... It was always easy to lose sight of it, but it's very easy to lose sight of it now, because the PSG's club culture appears to have swallowed him whole. Like, he's always had flaws with their personality issues. He had a bit of a temper in 2011 when they won the Copa Libertadores with Santos. He's like kicking a Peñarol fan after the game. It was a big... a Peñarol player. They had a big brawl. He was very immature. There was a lot of things that he can't make it in football. Having his son and moving to Barcelona really sort of stabilised him. He sort of matured a little bit, or at least he appeared to mature. At Barcelona with Iniesta and Messi keeping him on a short leash, he definitely reined in a lot of the excess that we now see basically just overflowing everywhere at PSG. He got injured. Everyone talks about he got injured. And it was because he got fouled like three times in... He got fouled. The guy kicked him like three times into it, and then he got up and did a rainbow. Instead of just saying, "Okay, I've clearly hurt myself," he got up and did a rainbow flick. It's like that was cool. Like, don't get me wrong; it's very cool to sort of humiliate your attacker like that. But at the same time, it's like be a bit more sensible.
I'm a big fan of getting kicked three times and then.
But at the same time, he must have known that he had hurt himself. So he thought, "I'm going to humiliate this guy," and he's done it, and it's great. It's a great moment, great gif. Great, you know, but it's now come at the cost of like Will says, it's denied him the chance to basically, because let's not be at the rush.
It's not a fair cost. It's not a just cost.
But with Neymar in the team, right? PSG steamroller Man United. I know they steamrolled them anyway and lost, but with Neymar, it's not even a contest. He is talent wise the second best player in the world. Like, there's no, he has been for a long time now. Production wise, when he's fit, and he still is. He's almost unplayable. But, you know, it's the club culture appears to just be affecting all the negative aspects about his career at the time in Barcelona are coming out in spades. Even Mbappe is now being swallowed up by the club culture, doing really snide things like not giving Cavani a penalty early. And then the tackle was horrific. I mean,
the tackle wasn't very nice.
Bad tackles can happen. So you don't want to be like too much, like, oh, he's become evil. But at the same time, it's just weird because Mbappe doesn't seem like he has any sort of nastiness in him. Before like this season, really, he just seemed like a really nice guy who was really focused on football. And now it's like all these snide things are coming out, and you just wonder more so than changing the manager that PSG maybe need to sort of look at their club culture. What is it? Do they pander to egos too much? Do they just not discipline the players? Is there no, who's the senior pro in the locker room? Like, since Zlatan left, who is it? Thiago Silva? I mean, come on.
The thing is with the disciplining players, they've literally not let Rabiot play because his mum and himself were moaning about a contract.
Well, that's, you know, the way the owners are treating not handling Neymar, not getting a lid on him. He clearly is a bit immature, which is fine. A lot of players are immature. He clearly needs a strong hand, a mature leader, and their mature leaders are Dani Alves, Thiago Silva. Dani Alves, Thiago Silva are both. I mean, Dani Alves is legendarily immature. But then there's Buffon, and I don't know why. Maybe it's the language thing. I don't know, but Buffon he's put out some very nice tweets and some very nice Insta posts and, you know, done a very good imitation of being a leader. But what we're seeing is not any way, shape, or form that he has any sort of influence in that locker room, because everyone is behaving like a bunch of errant children when there's no teacher in the class.
He didn't behave very maturely last season in the Champions League, to be fair.
There's that as well, yeah.
I think that's the thing, is with all footballers, it's very emotional and it's highly strung. Yeah. You're allowed to react in that way. It's, I do agree in the sense that PSG, there's a clear sort of battle for egos, and you've got Edison Cavani, who's probably been like the model professional that whole time, scoring 35 goals.
Yeah. He really has.
Quite
he
just, this is business.
This is it with PSG, though. I think it's almost if you live by the sword, then you die by the sword. Because if you're going to bring Neymar in for that sort of fee and put him on so much more money than everyone else, then that's obviously going to feed his ego.
And Javier Pastore donated his number 10 shirt.
I mean, like, stuff like that. Because it's when
even Alisson didn't take number one off Karius until this season, until the upcoming season. After he saw him on loan at Besiktas, he was like, "No."
Probably because he thought he was cursed or something after the Champions League.
But you know, I would just say Neymar is, you know. We should be Cavani's been really, really good. We should be careful, because I think as Will hinted at, Paredes has come in, and that's a big thing. They have missed, in terms of on the pitch, forget personnel for a second, on the pitch, strictly on the pitch, they've missed Motta's influence greatly. They really have. Verratti has had to do too much work in midfield. They've had Marquinhos in there. Marquinhos is a defender, you know, so what are you doing? But on the pitch, I think the addition of Paredes...
A defender that completely silenced Paul Pogba at Old Trafford.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, but that was a bodying job, you know.
I'm just saying that the tools...
Yeah.
Yes, Thomas Tuchel can say that they have not had enough players. And Rabiot, we all know, is a brilliant midfielder. Yeah. There's a reason that everyone would probably want to try and get him if you could cut ties. And I think he has even changed his agent now.
Yeah, that was
I'm
the
not
rumor.
Sure. But at the same time, you should be... You've still got a lot of players there with a lot of quality. And even their academy is really good. And
oh,
we're saying
God.
About
so good.
The players bringing through, they've let so many slip. Arsenal were linked with Yassine Adli, who... It looks like they were just trying to recruit a midfielder with floppy curly hair in the summer. And he eventually left to Bordeaux because he said, I want to stay at PSG and I want to earn my place. Saw no pathway. So eventually left and missed his opportunity to go to Arsenal potentially. So yes, he complains about the lack of players, but there's also, it's not, I think it was just purely the lack of players in one specific position that he's got Julian Draxler on the bench that doesn't play. And Di Maria has been incredible since Neymar's been out. It's just that the one hole in their midfield has derailed the whole
I think season. Paredes is going to be huge for them next season. He's already shown glimpses of it. I think you put Paredes and Verratti next year, especially if you make it a three with Rabiot. I mean, unless Rabiot leaves, in which case they might have to bring someone in. But you look at those three and then you put Mbappe up front with Cavani is probably... I mean,
they're looking at bringing in Herrera... And Idrissa Gueye they've been linked with.
Herrera's just a backup, isn't he? I mean, he would just be like sitting
but
on the
what
bench.
I'm saying, yes,
Herrera
he is
and
a backup.
They are pretty rubbish signings, I would say. They're not. They're not going to take them into the semi-finals.
Well, I don't know. I could see Idrissa Gueye being the type of player that you bring into a big club and he instantly just makes everyone around him better because he does a lot of the dirty work.
Which is what Herrera's praised for, and there was the stat, obviously, that Man United haven't lost in the Premier League with Herrera in the team under Solskjaer. He made all the difference. But again, he's not... I think I agree with Sam. Yes, they're probably going to be decent squad players, but they're going to need to... If he's complaining about midfield and you're getting Idrissa Gueye and Herrera, who are towards the end of their career as well,
but
it's they're not going to be selling many shirts.
If you're making... it's almost like they need the marquee signings, but then it feeds into the problem that we were talking about of you just got another ego coming in and then you've just...
The thing is, like with Herrera and Gueye, you could probably say, I've never heard Gueye do an interview, I don't think. So I don't think there's like an ego issue there necessarily. But moving away from PSG and the sort of, I think Will summed it up nicely there. It's not to the point you don't want to laugh at them anymore. You're just so disappointed that so many talent.
I won't go that far.
Fine then. I personally feel like Will summed it up well because I feel like they've got so many good players. If it wasn't in a PSG badge, you'd want them to see so well, do well.
Yeah, you want them to do well, and it's disappointing. Plus, their kit is lovely, the Jordan kit.
Yes, very nice kit as well. And another team that you sort of want to do well with the fact that they've got such a young team is Borussia Dortmund, who lost their first home game in the Bundesliga this season, and despite Jadon Sancho becoming the first English player to provide 14 assists in one of Europe's top five leagues since Frank Lampard which was impressive and one that I'd been waiting to happen. So I was glad he finally did that. But then he got a lighter thrown at him as well in the derby, which was obviously not what we want to see. And then they had two players sent off, one being Marco Reus and the other Marius Wolf, and they lost. Bayern nearly lost as well. So is the title out of their hands, Will?
I think it's less a case of the title being out of their hand. I actually think they're kind of in a... They're almost in a better position than Liverpool in the sense that... whereas Man City are on this 12-game winning streak and don't look like breaking that habit anytime soon, you could easily see Bayern losing to one of RB Leipzig, Mönchengladbach or Frankfurt on the final day of the season. But I just think it's the psychological blow of the result. And we said this after the 5-1 defeat to Bayern Munich as well, when we were sort of observing how their players came out and seemed quite downcast. Like after the derby defeat against Schalke, Lucien Favre came out and said the title race is over. I think he'll regret doing that now because, as you said, we've seen Bayern Munich go in and draw, and essentially that's 2 points ahead. They're now lose one game, Dortmund win one themselves, and I mean they're like an inch away from breaking the title streak of their biggest rivals. But I would say that you have to wonder whether Dortmund wouldn't be top of the league had Marco Reus not made that tackle in the 60th minute, because it was quite a smash and grab win from Schalke. Really, I think they scored from their four shots on target, one of which was scored from the free kick that Royce gave away. He obviously came out and apologised after the game, and so you can't really dispute that red card. You can dispute maybe the penalty that led to Schalke's opener as well. And in fact, the Schalke manager did come out after the game and said that he didn't agree with the decision to award that. It was sort of one of those VAR instances where it's exposed how badly the handball rule is written, because it did look a little bit more like ball to hand. It's also 3 points that will probably put their local rival Schalke out of reach for the relegation playoff that they were facing. So there's another big psychological, well, not a big psychological blow, just a displeasing side effect. Yeah. But the biggest psychological blow will probably be seeing Bayern go and draw 1-1.
And then the next day. A penalty that struck the post prevented all 3 points for Nuremberg.
That's a lot of peas.
I know, I tried to enunciate them all as well because I knew so many were coming. Those are the only two titles that now need to be decided. Obviously, Barcelona wrapped up and we're going to be talking about them in our Champions League section, obviously. Liverpool, Man City dominating the Premier League, and then Dortmund, Bayern, sort of, again, almost no one really taking control of that title race. So
shout out the Eredivisie though, they've got a nice title race going on. Ajax and PSV on level points.
Shout out Eredivisie, and guess who's in our Champions League semi-final?
Well,
I can't go around listing every title in Europe that's not been decided.
I was setting you up for a segue,
no, because we're taking a pause.
Actually, I think the Portuguese league's looking pretty tasty as well, isn't it?
Yeah. Benfica took a big step this weekend.
All right, I should never have mentioned anything.
Do you want to redo that bit?
No, we're not going to redo it. We're going to take a break and then we're going to dive into Champions League, which is only what people care about. So now into Europe's premium competition with the Champions League semi-finals approaching. Some really interesting ties, and we're going to start with Tuesday's match at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, which is now Mikel Antonio's stadium after he obviously inflicted their first defeat. But as Sam said earlier, getting a defeat out the way in the Premier League when they're just fighting for a top four might be good in the lead up to a semi-final against an Ajax side that seems them face four former players. Davinson Sanchez, Jan Vertonghen, Toby Alderweireld and Christian Eriksen will be looking to make an impact. But you could argue they wouldn't even get in this Ajax side at the moment, Mo, with what we sort of build already before when we were talking about the quarterfinals, pretty much the neutral's favourite to win the Champions League this season. But is there anyone that you love more than anyone else
This is going to surprise no one when I say Frankie de Jong, because Frankie de Jong is just... You know, there's that bit in Any Given Sunday when John C. Wright or John C. McGinley is writing about him. He's like, a new breed of athlete, warrior and man, a warrior poet. And I was like, that's me talking about Frankie de Jong, man. He's just something so special. It's like, how can a player be as physically dominant as he is, athletically dominant as he is? Like, you know, he can chase around the pitch and tackle people. He can dribble past people. He blew past N'Golo Kante when the Netherlands played France, like he wasn't even there. He mismatched well with Paul Pogba, which is incredible to do. And then he's such a technical player. He's such a technically refined player, such a perfectly poised player. You know, such a soft touch, such a great vision of the field and where to spread the ball, where to move with the ball, when to dribble, when not to dribble. He's like Paul Pogba with, you know, just a more sort of stable base. Like Pogba's a bit more of a expansive sort of like hit and miss kind of player, where Frankie's a bit more of a reserve kind of player, but has a lot of the similar kind of skills that Pogba obviously doesn't have the gigantic stride to eat up the pitch. But you watch Frankie play and you think there's no way a guy who's that tall should be that quick and that graceful and that elegant. You know, he's just remarkable to watch. And it's going to be really interesting watching him match up against, I'm assuming, Victor Wanyama.
Moussa Sissoko, who was, in my opinion, robbed of the Squawker Talker Most Improved Player.
I mean, I agree with you on that one. And I do agree. I want to see him match up against these two guys because they are... I mean, Wanyama is a phenomenal defensive midfielder when he's fully focused on his game. Sissoko has obviously had a revelatory season. In many ways, as revelatory as Frankie's season has been, to be honest. Although they're obviously at different ends of their career. But I just think it's going to be really interesting watching him compete, because you think he could probably control the game from where his position, especially aided by Donny van de Beek and Lasse Schürrle, who are very, very good midfielders on their own. Let's not overlook them completely. But it's just, you really wonder, because if Frankie can exert enough influence on this game, as he has done, by the way, against Real Madrid and Juventus in the previous two rounds, he's dominated all four of those games. So if he can do the same thing again at Spurs, do Spurs have anyone that can sit deep? Is Eriksen, or is it going to be Dele going to sit deep and try and press him? Is that what Potter's going to do? Try and counter press and stop Ajax from getting the ball to Frankie? Because that could be their main way of getting success. But yeah, Frankie's the one to watch. Oh, well, obviously, then there's De Ligt and there's Dusan Tadic. I mean, there's so many players to watch.
That's the thing with Spurs, is you've mentioned Eriksen and Dele Alli there as potential sort of players to put on that. But with Son missing because of suspension, Harry Kane obviously still injured at this moment in time. Who knows what the future holds with him? Pochettino voodoo might come out to get him fit for the second leg or even the final if they make it. Is it gonna mean less of an impact of the likes of Dele Alli and obviously the Christian Eriksen against his former side because they have to accommodate? We've seen Llorente and even Vincent Janssen has been playing in recent games. I'm pretty sure he's not even going to be registered for the Champions League squad.
No,
he's
not in the squad, no.
So what do Spurs do to obviously playing at home first, which they need to... We've seen Ajax have played the away leg first against Juventus and Real Madrid. Not won, but then gone through. So Spurs need to put this to bed by a few goals, really, if what we've seen from Ajax in this Champions League already, which has been incredible, is anything to go by. So how do Spurs set up to do that?
I mean, it's going to be really interesting for them from a mentality point of view, because they've definitely built up this underdog mentality throughout the Champions League. It's not quite full-blown Jose Mourinho, us against the world, but it's definitely... definitely a sort of... we're overachieving from Pochettino, because it's easy to forget that after three games they looked like they were done and dusted and heading to the Europa League, if not heading out with nothing. Then they weren't favourites against an informed Dortmund. This was back when Dortmund were obviously running away with the Bundesliga. And then they were made big outsiders against Man City, but now they're facing a team that they should beat on paper, at least.
They've nicked all their players, so
So put it this way: prior to the season, if you ask anyone who's competing in the Champions League, you have to beat Ajax to reach the final. Everyone would have to back themselves there. So it's, do Spurs take the game to Ajax, or knowing that they're sort of depleted with injuries, do they maybe just try and take a draw over there, score, and maybe a 1-0? Similarly, Ajax have huge expectations on them because they have, as the tournament's gone on, the more and more neutrals have been following them, and now they have that to deal with, that people want them to win, but they're expected to win this semi-final now as well.
Yeah, so they're the favourites in terms of likability, and approaching favourites in terms of bookmakers stuff as well, which is a hard, there's a lot of responsibility, as you've said. But the one thing about Ajax is what we've seen is in terms of them, you know what you're going to get. Ajax are going to play their style of football. Again, Man City broke a record against Man United in recent years, becoming the first English team to score 159 goals in the season. Ajax themselves, the first Dutch team ever to score 160 goals across all competitions in a season. Dusan Tadic, as you briefly mentioned, Mo, has had an absolutely brilliant season in himself. Then you've got Hakim Ziyech, who we've naturally, despite talking about Ajax quite a lot in these previews, never mentioned. And Ziyech looks like the player in his prime that will be plucked from that Ajax side when we're talking about De Jong and De Ligt being bought by Barcelona potentially and attracting the interest of every other club. You've got a 26-year-old playmaker who tops the charts for assists, chance created, shots every season he's been at Ajax.
Yeah, you know what, actually, I think the fact that no one talks about De Ligt is sort of, not De Ligt, sorry, Ziyech, is sort of like a really sort of big statement about how good he's been, how effortlessly good he's been. Like, he just looks like, yeah, that makes sense. Do you know what I mean? Like, with Frankie, you're like, oh my God, he is as good as you all hoped he would be. Hooray! And same thing with De Ligt. It's like, you hope they'll be good. But Ziyech is sort of in that position where it's like, yeah, no, yeah, that's, he's brilliant. We
that's
know
what
that.
He does.
Yeah, well, exactly.
There's obviously that gif of that crossfield pass.
Yeah.
It goes about 90 yards and it looks like he doesn't even try.
I also think that Van der Beek hasn't had his praises sung enough. I think he's going to be really important in the game.
And
we mentioned Sissoko and potentially Wanyama. Not particularly mobile, either of them. And I think Ajax...
Of course, Sissoko. I disagree with the mobility of Sissoko.
Well, with his injury, though.
The mobility of Sissoko. You can't pass around him. He's not exactly...
I'd say...
Too quick. Okay, he's a physical presence, but...
I'd say he covers a lot of ground.
He covers a lot of ground, yeah, but Ajax are going to be able to pass around him.
Okay.
If he's playing alongside Wanyama, which he's likely to, Wanyama is a fridge.
Wanyama's a fridge, okay. Yeah, fair enough. I just feel like with Sissoko, I've watched him this season, and I mentioned before that he's done all of Trippier's defending. So I'd be like, it's hard to get past Sissoko.
The way, the speed at which Ajax can go through the transition and move up the pitch, they're just going to be able to bypass Wanyama and Sissoko.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah, okay. But my point is that I feel like Sissoko is the one player Spurs will rely on to, if they do bypass, to recover and get it.
David,
I feel like that's my sort of point is, yes, obviously any midfielder can succumb to Ajax's passing and Ziyech as well, cutting inside, drifting it through.
David Neres versus Trippier is going to be very interesting. Yeah. That's going to be because he, I think even more than Ziyech, he's the one that no one talks about him at all, David Neres. And I think he's proven himself very good. He's very good against Real Madrid. Not quite as good in terms of performance against Juventus, but then scored that important goal. And Kieran Trippier, as we've all, has been just shocking all season, like not really played well at all. And no one's really made him pay for that in a massive, massive game yet. I think, like for Spurs, like a do or die game. I think this could be the time that Ajax sort of like, because if Tadic recognises that as a weakness, well, he might drift over there too. And then you've got a real problem. And I mean, this is the other thing as well, is Vertonghen and Alderweireld deal very easily with like threats coming in, crosses coming in, stuff like that. If they're having to deal with movement, fast movement from quick players, they can get pulled out of position. We've seen that before this season, especially against Barcelona, for instance. They can be pulled out of position into spaces where they don't want to be. There could be a lot of joy there for Ajax.
I think Vertonghen has been actually quite phenomenal, though, in the Champions
League. Oh, yeah, he's been very good.
No, I weren't saying you were saying that, but he's really stepped up. And their performance, obviously, his attacking performance against Dortmund at home and got them the win, and then he was an absolute rock when they went to Germany themselves. But this game in itself, as you said, saying Ajax and Spurs would be a semi-final of the Champions League before the season, you probably would have been laughed off. Considering that Spurs didn't make any signings and Ajax obviously from an Eredivisie which has been touted as the Farmers League among others. So we do have this though, and it's so good that we do have it because I feel like it's going to be a super exciting game. Ajax have not changed their style of play for anyone. Pochettino, a chance to finally get that trophy that everyone feels he needs. So with the first leg in London on Tuesday, Sam, coming to you first, any final thoughts you want to add, you can throw them in quickly. But we need to get some predictions for this match. And I want to know what yours is first.
I just wanted to make the point on sort of Spurs' big four of Kane, Ali, Eriksen and Son. With obviously Kane and Son out, it's so important that Ali and Eriksen step up. Ali's sort of gone off the boil of late. But I think it's going to be 1-1.
1-1. Will, first thoughts on this tie?
Oh, so I think Jose Mourinho said a little while ago that if you go toe-to-toe with Ajax, you're more likely to lose. The best, that's how he beat them in that Europa League final several years ago, was just sort of disrupting their game and making sure they're complaining about all these tactics you're inflicting on them. The advantage that they have is that they find themselves in a final four of teams that aren't really going to shy away from going toe-to-toe with you. And anyway, they've come through this test with Juventus, who were sort of like the defensive masters in terms of trying to negate the opponent's strengths. So this one depends for me on what tact Spurs take here, whether they try and sort of like slow the game down or try and sort of, you know, impress their ability and playing style on Ajax. The problem is they're at home, so they're less likely to do that. So I think this is going to be quite an entertaining game in which Ajax have their chance to sort of try and play through the lines, and they're not going up against a low block or a team that's going to be time wasting. So I can see it being maybe a 2-2.
Yes.
2-2.
Default.
I think this entire performance, the entire tie, frankly, but this entire leg definitely is going to hinge on how well Lloris plays in goal. If it's Hugo Boss, then Spurs probably have a chance. If it's Hugo Lowell Lloris, then they're going home. And I think it's going to be the latter.
I thought you were going to rhyme it.
I think
Hugo Boss or Hugo Loss.
Well, Hugo Loss, but I mean, that's, yeah. Well,
do you want us to go back and you can do that again and take Jake's suggestion?
No, I don't want to. You never redo a joke, man. Never go back. I would say I think it's going to be Hugo Loss. Against
just did redo the joke there,
and no, I didn't redo the whole joke. Well, I just did the punchline. I think Ajax is going to play well. I think Lloris is probably going to drop a clanger, and Ajax is going to win 3-2.
3-2. Well, that'll be a spicy game. My thoughts on it. I think just again the blueprint of Ajax this season has just been play really well on the away leg, but don't quite see it over.
That's the home leg.
I've just realised
it's the home leg. It's the away leg. They've done the business.
Oh, so this is it. So they're going to win 4-1 at the Spurs Stadium and then have a parade in Amsterdam for it. I can genuinely see them doing quite well. But I think Son being missed for that counter attack.
Yeah.
You've got Lucas that can do it, and obviously he's scored a hat trick recently. But I think you miss that chance to really just settle in and then unleash on Ajax. So I think this could be an Ajax win in a way. And I realised all my thinking about this whole thing was muddled, because I was always going to say Ajax were going to win at Spurs. So I think 2-1 to Ajax here. And then, obviously, the second Champions League semi-final sees the man that cannot be dribbled past versus the man that can dribble past anyone, as Liverpool travel to Camp Nou on Wednesday. Another tie, which is mouth-watering in all of the narrative that is there. Barcelona obviously wrapped up the La Liga title already. Liverpool's still fighting for the Premier League, which could be a sort of decisive factor within the mindset of how to approach the game. Lionel Messi makes history and becomes the first Barcelona player to win 10 La Liga titles, and he finally got to lift one. And the trophy itself looked bigger than him.
It was quite apt that he lifted it. The tiny little moment where he's
lifting it on his own.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It's apt, isn't it, that he lifted it all by himself, while his teammates are standing off in the background like going, yeah, well done.
Which is, you could be cynical and argue that's how they're going to approach this game against Liverpool. Leave it all to Lionel Messi, obviously the man that has been the scourge of English teams in the Champions League, the most goals against them in the competition. But Liverpool are not on the list.
No, they're not.
So really, Mo, is this the time, with the La Liga title wrapped up, with Lionel Messi saying, I saw some reports this morning just on Reddit and from other areas, saying that he felt like he was in the best shape possible for this Champions League tie. He's been coming off the bench to keep the freshness, but not starting, winning them La Liga with his goal. Is this just destined for Lionel Messi to deliver that promise that he promised at the start of the season.
I mean, destiny's a fickle thing, isn't it? So let's not go that far. But look, it does look like it's all sort of leaning Barcelona's way. Their quarterfinal, they finally got an easy team to play in the quarterfinal. They've drawn three very difficult quarterfinalists at the moment, where they're physically at their lowest ebb of the season: Atletico Madrid, Juventus, and Atletico Madrid again, and that and Roma. Sorry, that sort of cost them. But now they've got Man United, they've got past that, and then traditionally they've always stepped up their game into the final months of the season and played really well, which obviously recent years hasn't involved the Champions League. Now it involves the Champions League. Valverde, whatever you want to say about Ernesto Valverde, and there's plenty to be said about him. I've said a lot. He does like big games. Barcelona routinely in La Liga this season, they haven't lost, I think, at all to like Sevilla, Valencia, Villarreal.
Was that Roma game last season not a big game then?
Well, I mean, like that was the one, isn't it? That's the one thing where you're thinking, wait a minute, huh? It sort of derails every other narrative that he's built around himself. It's like, you know, so much of what he's done at Barcelona has been right, whether or not you appreciate the style. And there are many people who don't, you know, think it's quite boring and everything. And he kind of makes watching Barcelona a bit of a slog. But in big games, with the exception of Roma away, which was a disaster, they tend to step up. They tend to be really, really good. They play their best football. They were magnificent at Wembley earlier in the season. They play their best football and they're effective football. They're very hard to beat. They're a bit, because Piqué is now more of a veteran, Busquets is a veteran, they're a bit savvier than they were. You know, like for example, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, Liverpool could probably have played their counter-pressing game and absolutely sent Barcelona into a tailspin. Might still happen, but it's less likely now. There's a bit more of assurance. Messi in particular, as you said at the start of the season, I want to win the Champions League. It's about time I win it again. He's been the best player in the competition so far. He's been absolutely brilliant.
And Dusan Tadic says hi.
Well, that's a fair shout, to be fair. That's a fair shout. But he's been one of the best two players in the tournament so far. And I think he's, you know, Liverpool are the one team, I think the one big team he's played more than once in his career and never scored against. Along with maybe Inter, I think, as well. Inter as well. So he'll want to score against Liverpool just because he always loves scoring against opponents. And, you know, but it's we've got the best attacking player in the world versus the best defender in the world, isn't it? It's the beautiful match. Mm. Who's gonna come out on top? Irresistible force or the immovable object?
And what's so good about it this time is that because Messi is one of those left-footed wizards, he'll actually be cutting onto Van Dijk's side, where Van Dijk's been hiding from all of the actual good wingers by playing as a left centre back. The last time Barcelona lost a Champions League knockout match at Camp Nou with Lionel Messi in the 11 was in February 2007, thanks to goals by Craig Bellamy and John Arnorisa. Mm-hmm. Can Liverpool repeat the feat from 12 years ago, Will?
I don't think they will, and a part of why I don't think they will is that I expect to see the most conservative midfield Jurgen Klopp could possibly assemble going into this game. Interestingly, obviously, Naby Keita has come into some form, and that was evident in how his pressing as part of the four-player press that they sort of
trapped,
you know, just unleashed upon Huddersfield in 15 seconds is like exemplifies his improvement and just how well he is sort of adapting to Jurgen Klopp's style. But I've got an inkling that we'll see James Milner come in to Klopp's lineup in this game alongside Henderson and Wijnaldum. Fabinho is also a defensive player that we could see in the lineup. He was out of the squad against Huddersfield, I'm pretty sure, after the head injury they picked up previous week. But the reason I can see James Milner coming into this game is his ability to sort of step in and fill in for the fullback. His fullback teammates is going to be key in exploiting any space that Barcelona leave behind Jordi Alba or Semedo if he plays on the other flank. So I think that'll be Liverpool's game plan, because the risks of attacking down those channels are obviously lower than going through the middle. Elsewhere, it looks like Liverpool's prayers have been answered and that Sergio Busquets faces a difficult evening potentially, in that Roberto Firmino is expected to be fit and start. Coming back to Keita not being in the 11, I think the other reason for that is that the pressing that will be exerted on Barcelona's like playmaking ability in the middle of the park was going to come from the front line, because it's a little bit safer to do that than to sort of use one of your players in the second line of the formation to do that. So I think he'll get like the sort of Aaron Ramsey treatment that Jorginho got in the Chelsea-Arsenal game that we referred to Early on in the season, Dele Alli also does this pretty well, is when you sort of like you come back on the holding midfielder from the front line. I don't think it will necessarily work, but I can see it helping Liverpool keep the score down. I don't think they'll get a draw or a win, but I think it'll keep the score down and give them a chance going into the Anfield leg.
And if there's one midfielder that is probably immune to any sort
exactly, yeah.
Press resistant is the term thrown around for anyone that can sort of turn.
Yeah.
But Sergio Busquets has proved.
Yeah, that's another reason why I don't think any kind of sort of pressing on him is going to come from the middle, because that will just leave Liverpool's back line exposed.
Exactly. That's the thing, when you step up to press Busquets, he just steps past you and then there's a massive gap behind you. And so I think if you bring Firmino back, Will's absolutely right, you bring Firmino back, much less risk posed. And plus then also, frankly, you can keep tabs on Arthur and Rakitic, who are going to be the ones that start alongside him. And they shouldn't be overlooked, especially Arthur is almost as press resistant as Busquets. He's been a huge figure in the Champions League. He can only really play for 60 minutes because he's been playing since the start of 2018. He came from Brazil. So he can only really manage about an hour. But for that hour, he's incredible. And the thing is, then, of course, then Barca switch up and bring on Vidal for him. And Vidal's a completely different animal. Completely different animal. Like James Muller versus Arturo Vidal is going to be...
I saw Vidal has obviously not played near as many minutes, 800 minutes less than the most Barcelona in La Liga this season. Committed the most fouls by about 20.
Yeah.
I was looking through, because obviously he won his 8th consecutive top flight title this weekend.
Yeah.
King Arturo for a reason, but he is genuinely being brought on as a hatchet man. In the sense that you're saying that Valverde is perhaps this more pragmatic Barcelona manager than you've ever seen.
Yeah.
Vidal comes on to stop anyone, Barcelona take the lead, probably through Lionel Messi. Mm-hmm. Vidal comes on and seems to just slow everything down and make sure no one has a chance of even pegging them back. But the one thing that we haven't mentioned, obviously, as well, is we said all the Ajax players playing against former graduates of their esteemed academy.
Yeah.
Luis Suarez and Coutinho aren't exactly graduates of Liverpool, but they were part of the most exciting sides in recent seasons. And Luis Suarez especially, who the leg at home first, given his awful away record in the Champions League knockout stages... are they going to turn up? Is Coutinho one going to play, because Dembele's been making his way back in slightly, and can we see them coming back to haunt?
Firstly, I would say Coutinho. I would credit Liverpool almost entirely for Coutinho's return, because he was a flop basically when they signed him. I mean, Espanyol to a degree mainly kickstarted it, but Liverpool really brought him to the prominence, to the world class player he is. I think for Suarez he was brilliant, and he just became a bit more brilliant when he was there. I think Coutinho's going to start. He came off at half-time again at the weekend, which to me is a big indicator that Valverde is very happy with him and he wants to save him for the Champions League. He has started playing better in the last... it's really bizarre. It's almost like, oh, Liverpool were coming. Okay. And now he's decided to start playing better. Obviously, and it all started off against Man United of all teams as well. So it's like the Premier League, a bit return to the comfort zone for him. And he's just sort of finding his form. He's playing better than he has basically all season. So I do think Dembele will come off the bench. Plus also, frankly, if you're talking about substitute impact, Dembele is a much better sub because he's faster and more direct. And if he was fit and flying, maybe it would be no contest, but because he's coming back from injury, I think Coutinho will get the start. I think he will do some damage. I think Suarez is going to save all his mojo for the away leg. I think he hasn't scored an away Champions League goal since September 2015.
It's like a day of playing time.
It's been so long. And I just think... it's bound to happen, isn't it? Anfield away. It probably won't even be a good goal. It'll either be a stunning volley or it'll just be like some sort of trickly tap in that he does. But Coutinho, I think, will do some damage against Liverpool. I think he'll be very motivated to sort of... He's already been humiliated enough this season. He won't want to then play so terribly against his old club and be like, ha, you left us and look how rubbish you are. I think he'll very much want to sort of impress himself. I think he can do. I think Matip is... If Matip is the guy he's going up against, I think he matches up quite well against Matip.
Also, the one thing I was going to say on that, just quickly, is we've seen Trent Alexander-Arnold obviously be one of the best distributors of the ball in the Premier League this season. Full stop. Obviously, him and Robertson, 20 assists combined in the Premier League. But Klopp has shown, not always, it's not a pattern that he always employs, but there's a tendency to swap him out for Joe Gomez... when you want to be a bit more solid. And you've already mentioned the midfield is going to be quite solid, Will. Joe Gomez and Oxlade-Chamberlain look like they'll be available, at least for this game. Do you just put in a defender against Coutinho, who you know what he's going to do? And Alexander-Arnold, as I said, is so good on the ball that you play him when you're going to dominate. But he has been beaten quite a lot this season. There's been games where he's obviously stood up to Sané. I'm not saying that he's a weak link. I'm saying, is this where Klopp will be battling that decision in his head, in my opinion? Like, do I play Trent and trust him, or is Joe Gomez the man for this occasion?
I think it maybe just comes a little bit too soon for Joe Gomez. I'm pretty sure that Oxlade-Chamberlain came on before Joe Gomez in the Huddersfield game.
Yeah. And nearly scored.
Yeah, I it was first touch, pretty much. I think it's a really good point, and I could see it happening. It had, like I said, Joe Gomez played a few more minutes.
Yeah, for number two.
Exactly.
Two games
maybe just like a case of 1 or 2 weeks. He might do that in the Anfield game. Yeah. I don't know, because it certainly was something he was doing earlier on in the season. I would say as well, there have been a few good defensive performances from Trent. So
it's going to be.
Yeah, that's what
I think. I know, and I know you're not making the point. And I think you almost referred basically to the last season's game against Man City, where they clearly targeted him as the weak link, and it almost backfired because Sané was just unable to.
It's going to be interesting though, because I think to that point, I think last year City went at him, but it was 1v1 duels. It was Sané versus Alexander Arnold.
Yeah.
This season, it won't be that. Coutinho's not going to size him up and go in 1-on-1. Dembele might try that, but Coutinho will probably cut in field, and then it's Jordi Alba in the overlap. And handling that overlap is huge. United, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, both legs, five at the back, because he knew if we cut off that overlap, a lot of what makes Valverde's Barca special is gone, and it's just mainly just waiting for Messi to do something magical. Turns out he did something magical, and they got beat. But if they can cut off the overlap, Liverpool aren't going to change to five at the back, right? So that's not going to happen. But if Alexander-Arnold if Milner just goes over and, you know, to Will's point, help him.
That's Will's point about Milner playing midfield, I think, it's covering that space. And also, the final little duel, we've not even really spoken about Van Dijk and Messi that much. A lot of our coverage that we've got planned from social point of view as well will involve those two.
Thor versus Captain America.
Exactly. So you don't need to listen to us talk about it. But going back to a discussion we had the other week, just finally before predictions, Jordi Alba, Andy Robertson was the debate of best left back in the world, and now we're going to see it.
Well, now it is. Now winner takes it all. You know?
Winner takes all. We're going to see whether James Milner can help crush Jordi Alba, and Robertson can rampage up that.
I know James Milner's like Robertson's left back sort of mentor, in the sense of like this Liverpool team coming in, even though not a traditional left back.
Robertson could be very interesting.
If you see like all the sort of, the interview and sort of like content that Liverpool's official website puts out, they seem to have quite a nice little bond to those two. So it would be a cute little bond that we might just see Milner helping his mate Robertson out in this one.
A big thing for Robertson is going to be who plays right back for Barcelona. Yeah. Because if it's Semedo, Robertson could be, I don't want to say shut down, but limited. Semedo's an excellent defender. Yeah. If it's Sergio Roberto, mate, Robertson's going to have he's going to have so much fun.
Who do you think is going to play
those? Sergio Roberto's going to play.
Semedo started the most recent game.
Yeah, but that's the point. He played the weekend. He didn't play a lot in the midweek. I think Valverde values Sergio Roberto, what he brings to them on the ball. This is the home leg. So if it was away from him, if it was at Anfield, maybe you could argue Semedo will start. As they're going to be at the camp now, he didn't play at the weekend. I think it's almost guaranteed Sergio Roberto is going to start, which could open up a lot for Robertson on the overlap, I think.
All of these battles are going to be contested. And as we said, it's only the second one. We could have done a whole podcast on this semi-final itself, but we're not. We're going to finish this podcast with your predictions. And Sam, you gave us your knowledge for Spurs Ajax, and you've not had a chance to chip in yet about Barcelona Liverpool. So that's why I'm coming to you first for a prediction. Listening to what everyone said, the battles, the duels, what is the score going to be?
Well, first off, on Milner, he's definitely got bad memories of the Camp Nou.
Yeah.
The last time he got nutmegged by Messi, and it became the meme.
Because I was going to make the point that he might play him for his experience. I intentionally left that out because that experience involves the nutmeg that we got. That actually gave us a quite nice Pep Guardiola gif, reaction gif, because he was watching that game, I think.
I remember.
I think it would be 2-1 to Barca with Coutinho scoring one of his curlers.
Shimmy and shoot after leaving Trent Alexander-Arnold.
The problem with Suarez, Coutinho and Messi all playing is that the chances of a narrative like ridden goal is just like 99% pretty much. it's almost going to be like it'd be more remarkable, more of an interesting storyline if one of them didn't. An ex Liverpool player or a player who is extra incentivized to score against Liverpool like Messi doesn't score. that would be the biggest twist for me.
We'll see who Jordi Alba's
steaming
through.
There's still time for someone to knock it out of the pot like Craig Bellamy.
Yeah, exactly. That's what we, as I said before, Liverpool are looking to repeat what they've only been able to do since Messi really sort of emerged as this world greatest that he is. So did you say a score there?
No,
were
I
you
didn't.
Skirting?
Well, I think 2-1 Barcelona.
You alluded to the result.
I was coming to a result and I specifically didn't because I didn't want you to get cross at me.
Yeah.
But yeah, my prediction is 2-1.
2-1 with Milner getting that make four times.
Yeah. I think Barcelona take the lead early on. I think they dominate the game, but I think they get a bit too complacent. A la classic Valverde style, Liverpool get back into it. But I do think Barca will have the quality in the end to just see them over the edge. I do think Coutinho will play a big part. I think he'll probably score a goal. And then Dembele as a sub, I think he's just going to be a bit too much for a game changer for Barcelona. I think they'll give him the edge. I don't think Suarez will score. I think he's saving his mojo for Anfield. I think it'll be 3-1, but Barcelona's third goal will be very late on.
3-1, wow. I genuinely, the more I watch Liverpool, they're so, so good. And I genuinely think that they're built to punish Barcelona, relying on Gerard Pique defending 1v1. And it might go a bit more sort of... I remember Liverpool were criticised for being a long ball team by Fernandinho or saying they played a lot of long balls. But I can see them using that exact tactic. And Mo Salah and Sadio Mane at the moment have again hit an incredible streak of form at the right time. We were talking about Man City as a team winning all those games in a row. You've got two players that scored 20 plus Premier League goals this season. Mane, remember, has scored in every round of the Champions League since the start of last group stage.
Yeah, I do think Mane is going to be the one that scores for Liverpool. Just
And I think they're both going to score and it'll be 2-1 to Liverpool at Camp Nou. A repeat. And Sadio Mane is the stealer of celebrations, isn't it? So don't
celebration stealer.
So expect him to be swinging his driver.
Barca's last loss at home in the Champions League was in the semi-final against Bayern Munich in 2013.
Yeah, Messi didn't play.
Yeah, 5th of May 2013. And then obviously with Messi, like you say, it's 2007.
That would be the definition of a deep cut celebration if Mane went for the Craig Bellamy goal swing.
I think he's done his research. And then Risa obviously scored the winner. Maybe Robertson will get his left-back crown. Steaming forward and getting his goal. But that is all we've got time for this week. Again, another bumper episode, if you will, with so much football to talk about. So just leaves me to just say thank you for everyone joining us. Mo, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Will, thank you for coming on.
You're more than welcome.
Sam, thank you for joining us.
Cheers, mate.
Avengers assemble.
Exactly. Look out for our Endgame Champions League content this week. And if you hadn't already seen, catch up on your Squawker Talker Award winners. Rate, review, subscribe to the podcast, all of those lovely things. And we will see you, which won't be next Monday. In fact, the podcast next week will be slightly delayed. So keep an eye out because we will be giving you one at least.
You just said you're going to give the listeners one.
Breaking news, and this one is almost unbelievable.
Yeah, it's all about new customers at Bet365 because they get $150 in bonus bets when they bet $5, win or lose. And even better, bonus bets can be used on the spread, totals, and player props.
There you have it. Bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. And see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. T&Cs apply. Available in app only.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.